Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X-Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. We're coming to you live from deep beneath the Earth in western Kentucky. The solar wind is a mild 554.7 kilometers per second, and a little sunspot 986 is just one day old and already fading away. Earth is not inside a solar wind from a coronal hole right now, yet last night there was a dazzling display of aurora borealis. Strange how these new instruments placed by the Themis project a year ago from NASA are revealing that there is little correlation between the solar wind and the northern lights. Perhaps there is another source for the ionic ribbons we see in the night sky. A British company has developed a camera that can detect weapons, drugs, or explosives hidden under people's clothes from up to 25 meters away in what could be a breakthrough for the security industry. The T5000 camera, created by a company called TrueVision, uses what it calls passive image technology to identify objects by the natural electromagnetic rays known as terahertz or T-rays that they emit. The high-powered camera can detect hidden objects from up to 80 feet away and is effective even when people are moving. It does not reveal physical body details, and the screening is harmless, the company says. The technology, which has military and civilian applications and could be used in crowded airports, shopping malls, or other sporting events, will be unveiled at a scientific development exhibition sponsored by Britain's Home Office on March 12th through 13th. A star that died 340,000 years ago has provided fresh evidence that the energetic particles known as cosmic rays are being fired out by supernova. Now, Italian researchers Marco Salvati of Arcetri Astrophysical Observatory in Florence and Bruno Saccio of the National Institute for Astrophysics in Palermo suggest that an ancient supernova, which created the Geminga pulsar, is responsible for a slight excess in cosmic rays from one part of the sky. Interesting. Many of us believe that supernovas are responsible for the higher order elements in our periodic chart. Clay-encrusted boulders recently discovered on Mars are evidence of ancient and perhaps once habitable lakes, a new study finds. A spectrometer on MRO, called CRISM, discovered that the rocks are covered by layers of fine sediments and clay, which forms through prolonged contact with water. This points to conditions in early Mars history that were really quite different, remarkably so, from what we see today. The first lake probably lasted for thousands of years before drying up. If we were looking on Earth for an environment that preserves signatures related to habitability, this is one of the kinds of environments we would target. It seems that liquid water in our solar system isn't as rare as once thought. This week on X-Squared Radio, we have one of the brightest voices in the UFO genre. She is the author of a book called Blue Star. She has been in lifelong contact with the tall, blonde aliens and has been given a message for us that will be shared here tonight on X-Squared Radio. Please welcome with me Miriam Delicato. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you doing tonight?
Oh, I'm doing excellent. Back in western Kentucky for a few days, doing a little Easter egg hunting and visiting with grandkids.
Well, that sounds great, as I'm sitting here in Hopi Land and very excited to be talking with you tonight.
Oh, this is going to be an amazing evening. Usually about 5 or 6 minutes after X-Squared Radio starts, we fill up the servers. So I want to go ahead and let everyone know that you can call in any time during the 3 hours tonight. We're going to open the phone lines all night because there's a lot to cover. Toll-free, USA, 888-228-4494. Anywhere toll-free in Canada, 877-489-6350. And anywhere else on Earth, in the Earth, if you can reach a cell phone tower, you can get to us at 530-776-5154. We also have a second line, 530-776-5185. And those numbers are good for Europe, for New Zealand, for Australia. Any place on the planet wants to reach us, you can reach us at those numbers tonight. Miriam, from time to time, we here at this program meet people who know people who have seen a UFO. And recently we learned from none other than Fox News that 47% of Americans have actually seen a UFO. That's 164 million people who have had first-hand witness activity with a UFO. But this is the first time I have had a chance to sit down and talk to an actual contactee. Your new book, Blue Star, is a very personal recollection of your lifetime contact with the tall, blonde aliens. I was inspired and I was touched by this witness, and I want us to share that with our listeners tonight. This is your first book, right?
Yes, it is.
Well, I'm completely amazed because, you know, like all good stories, yours starts from the earliest times and you move to, you know, rather interesting levels in it, both personal and very first person. So maybe we could just kind of start in the beginning. Tell us about your first experience when you lived in Canada that you can remember. I think the book kind of starts when you're 16 or 17 and works its way back to when you're 5, but let's start at the beginning if we can.
The very first contact that I ever had with them, I would have to say, was when I was a baby. And
okay.
I remember, you know, when I was laying in my crib, you know, very strange memories from that time, because I remember laying there crying, not being able to move very well, trying to communicate with my mother and not having the tools that I needed to be able to communicate with her. So it was very frustrating for me. And also around that time, I had memories of these beings floating around me. And so I would have to say that my very, very first contact would have been when I was a baby, which is very interesting because, of course, most people don't even have that memory of that time in their lives. Usually memories of childhood don't start until much, much, much later in life.
Well, your family moved to a very interesting house when you were very young. Can you tell us about your family's experiences at that house?
Yes. When I was about 9 years old, we moved into a house that my father built. And, of course, us kids, we helped him as well. And when we moved there, there was all sorts of strange happenings that were going on in and around the house, even as we were building it. Now, once we moved in, my two sisters, my mom, they would often hear things moving and shuffling around in the basement. Or
really?
Things would get moved. Sorry?
I was saying, really? I mean, like they had, like, a poltergeist in a brand new house?
Yes, and it was really strange because we actually tried to figure it out, and I kept saying, well, maybe we're on some ancient burial site or something, because there was no reason for it. And, of course, when we dug the hole for the house itself, I don't remember ever, you know, finding anything there. But there was no real explanation for why there was all of these crazy sounds in the house and movements and that sort of thing. So that was around the age of 9. And what was interesting about that particular time in my life was that, you know, I never heard or saw anything. I don't remember hearing or seeing anything. I just know that everyone that came into our house at that time would have difficulties in one form or another, and it took on a whole life of itself. You know, people would come over and they'd have a bad experience seeing something, like eyes coming at them, or a chair would move, and they'd never come back again. So
wow. Now I know in one guy that came and visited your house, there was a bouncing ball in the house.
Yes, he was, of course, down in the room in the basement, and there was what we used to call super balls. I don't know if any of the listeners would remember what those were. They're tiny round balls that you could make them bounce really, really high. And apparently what happened with him was this ball all of a sudden started moving all by itself in the house and started bouncing. And it became so hot. It was bouncing so far up and down that it was hitting the ceiling and the floor. And nobody had touched it. And it was just smashing itself, ceiling to floor, ceiling to floor. And the story goes, because of course I wasn't there at the time, that he ran out of the house and wouldn't even come back in until... you know, he wouldn't come back to get his things. We had to pack them up and off he went.
Now, why do you think, if this was an entity, why do you think it didn't mess with you?
Well, strangely enough, I knew that it couldn't mess with me. I was about 9 or 10 years old at the time, and I knew that it couldn't do anything to me. I wasn't afraid of it. I mean, it made me nervous. I never wanted to go in the basement, but somehow, deep inside of myself, I knew that it could not do anything to me. And
were you ever were you able to get it to listen to you or make it go away?
Well, I would sit down in the evenings, you know, at bedtime, if it had been on sort of a rampage where it was going crazy for weeks on end or days on end, and wasn't leaving anyone alone, and I would just do a simple little prayer, and I would say, "Dear God, please protect me and my family from whomever or whatever lives in the basement." And then, whatever lives in the basement, I demand that you come to me instead of going to anyone else tonight. And I knew that that had to do with universal law, that if there was someone of lesser power than yourself, you are not allowed to, quote, use your powers against them because they have no way of protecting themselves. And that, in turn, would make it so that that entity or being would have serious consequences as a result of messing with someone lower than them. And I knew that that was the way that it was for everyone, not just for that being. So I would do this little prayer, and then, you know, I'd have horrible, horrible nightmares all night long about fighting these flames in the basement. But I would wake up the next day, and my family would simply have had a great night's sleep and didn't hear anything. So it obviously worked.
Very interesting. And you say you were about 9 or 10 when you did this?
That's about, I think probably closer to 10 years old when I started to do that. About 9 and a half, 10 years old, yes. Because we moved in just after I was 9 years old. That house just after we were 9.
Mm-hmm. I got you. So, and how long did you live there?
Well, I had a difficult life growing up, and I lived in that house for about 3 years until I was about 12 years old. And at that point, you know, for a couple of years after that, between 12 and 14, I was just not in the home. I was in foster homes and that sort of thing. So,
well, let me ask you about other abilities maybe that began to surface as you got older. You say your first contact with the aliens was when you were a baby, but obviously you didn't remember that at this time in your life. But other abilities gifts maybe that you had, were starting to make themselves known as you matured. And what were those like?
Well, it's very complex because initially when I was about, you know, two, 3 years old, I started playing little games of trying to read people's minds. But that didn't necessarily bring anything to the surface for me. But it was probably closer to around the age of, 10 years old when I started understanding what universal law was.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't give it a second thought, really. And then as I got to be closer to about 12 years old, 13, that's when things really started to lift up. And I started having premonitions and dreams that, of course, were looking into the future. I did all sorts of things. I could remote view and read people's minds. I could, I don't know.
Were you able to heal anyone?
Yes, when I was younger, I did do healings on people, which, there was one girl in particular who had warts all over her hands, and I simply held her hands, because I told her that I would get rid of them, and I simply just held her hand, and I said, just give me a minute, and her hand started to tingle, and she wanted to pull away, and I said, no, you have to wait, and she held her hands there. And, I just imagined that it just basically disintegrated with this energy that I was sending her. And they did go away within a couple of weeks. And they covered her hands from her wrist all the way down.
Wow. Now, by the time you were 13, your gifts of sight came into full development. How did you discover you could remote view so well?
Well, that was kind of a funny story. I didn't have the language of any of these things. And even to today, I still feel as though I bumble around with things because, I haven't taken any classes and, listened to a lot of people and lectures and things like that for people to say exactly what it is that I do and don't do. But when I was about 13 years old, a friend of mine was, she was just out of touch with me and my other girlfriend. And we wanted to know where she was. So we decided, well, I seem to know so much and can do so many things. Why don't I try and see if I can figure out where she was? And that's how I laid down and focused in on her and then had an extremely clear, crystal clear vision of her in a car with an older man on their way to the next town over, and that they were going to be back in a couple of days. And the color of the car was blue. And
wow. That's a lot of detail. What happened did she ever show back up?
Well, a couple of days later, we saw her at school, said hello, asked where she was and what she was doing. And she just basically told us that she was in the next town over. And of course, we knew all of this detail and said, oh, well, you were with some older guy. And she was shocked that we even knew about it. But she confirmed all of the details. In a blue car, next town over.
Did you tell her how you knew?
I beg your pardon?
Did you tell her how you knew?
Yes. I'm laughing because she knew all about my abilities. There was very few people at that point in my life that knew about the extent of what it was that I was doing. And she was one of them. So she wasn't... Both of my friends were surprised, definitely, but we weren't completely shocked because at that point, I was having a lot of visions, and images of things coming to me all the time. So, it wasn't
how old were you at that time?
At that time, I believe I was 13.
Wow. Like many people with strong natural talent, and you say you didn't have to go to classes for remote viewing, and maybe classes would do you good, or maybe it wouldn't. I mean, it's obvious that you have raw talent. But like many like that, you left home early and went out on your own. And, the challenge of learning responsibility for one's own actions sometimes overwhelms some of us. How did you learn to overcome these challenges?
Well, You know, when you're living daily life, you need to focus in on one thing. And regardless of how old a person is, they need to focus in on themselves. They need to constantly remind themselves that they are a wonderful human being, that they, that regardless of how different they may feel, or maybe even that they are, that they still have a right to be that person. And, you know, you need to kind of stand up for yourself. And that's the way I overcame a lot of things. That's how I dealt with my abilities. I, you know, pushed through them. I shared a lot of that with my sister at the time. And then as far as my difficult life growing up, I mean, I shared with people that I was very cautious with and careful as far as what it was that I would tell them and about myself. And, you know, just being strong with yourself, I think, is really important in any life at any time. You need to be strong with yourself. And
I know most 13-year-olds that I know have no self-restraint whatsoever. With these gifts, did you learn prudence with them, or did you just, you know, share whatever came to you whenever and not really worry about the consequences?
Oh, no, that was actually always in the, it's hard to explain because it's so emotional. It was always so deeply thought. It was a thought process.
Do
I share this with the individual? Because, you know, premonitions and dreams that people have maybe of something that's coming with another individual. I mean, I still struggle with it. And it needs to have thought because, you know, when someone like myself can walk up to someone and say, for example, my sister, having a premonition about her in a car accident, you know, you need to be careful how you say it. You need to be careful when, and even if you say something, do you need to be straightforward with them and say, I had this premonition, I don't want you to do this? Or can you say, will you please pick me up an hour earlier that day? You know what I mean?
So
there's always a great deal of thought process, and it's an excellent question. However, it's almost impossible for me to fully answer because with each premonition, with each thought, it's almost like having a mathematical equation going on in your mind as to whether or not you should or can or are supposed to share it with the individual. But I definitely struggled with that most of my life. The one great thing that I learned from that, though, which is very relevant to today, is that I realized that all premonitions and all, you know, predictions of any kind that you maybe have foreseen, such as the things that I'm talking about in my book, are gifts to us, and that these are simply messages from another time that have melted into this time, and that they are the gift of, you know, choosing a path in life. So we have that opportunity to choose as to which direction it is that we're going to be taking. And so, the gift is not the premonition. The gift is the gift of choice, and then the greatest thing that could possibly happen is that the premonition becomes false. Because if it becomes false, it means that we've chosen a different path. Am I making sense?
Sure. In premonitions, like maybe prophecies sometimes, they're conditional upon things. And sometimes getting the knowledge that something is going to happen, you're then involved in that event, whether you like it or not. And you know, I believe, and we say all the time on this program, everything we do will eventually affect the universe. So we try to do it on purpose. It's easy in retrospect, you know, when you're 30 or 40 or 50 or 60 to pontificate with great wisdom on what we should and should not do when we're given this information. But when you're 13, do you have that wisdom? Did you have that wisdom? Or did you, like most 13-year-olds that I know, act impulsively and share without consideration of the consequences, whatever came to you? For instance, if one of your friends who had a premonition, you're going to be in a car wreck, I think you should ride with your mom tomorrow. That's what a 13-year-old would say. A 30-year-old would say, gee, do I run this mathematical program in my mind, and do I tell her, or do I say, come pick me up an hour early? What happened when you were 13? How did you deal with having these gifts? Because you realized at that time everyone didn't have them, right?
Right. I did. Well,
and you knew you were different.
I knew. Oh boy, did I know I was different. I knew I was very different. Well, one of the greatest gifts that I had was my older sister. Now, she was always very supportive of me of these gifts that I had, and I often shared them with her.
Now,
at the same time, you know, so there was someone there to sort of bounce things off of. She was 4 years older than me. But her, even for her, you know, what you're saying, actually, if I give it a little bit more thought looking back on it, she was a little bit more, quote, impulsive than even I was. Because, of course, if I shared with her a premonition of some kind, she would immediately be bouncing all over it. For example, one of the most traumatic, I mean, I've had several that have been really traumatic to me, meaning they were very upsetting. One in particular was about a plane crash, and it was very vivid. And I knew that the plane was going to crash, and I knew that 230-some people were going to die. I think it was 230, but it was over 200, and I knew that it was going to happen in the next 3 days, and so forth. I had all of these details, and of course I was very upset by this because I thought, well, what is the purpose? What is the purpose of this? And in my sister...
Yeah, what are you going to do with knowledge about a plane crash? You're not flying on it. You can't call up the National Air Traffic Safety Board and tell them that the plane's going to crash. What do you do with that knowledge?
Well, I realize that sometimes, especially when we're younger, we get premonitions like that to show us, to teach us that these things are part of the process of life, and
that
it's a matter of just trying to realize that we're dealing with other dimensions and other worlds. I think that was part of the process. You know, some of these things that happened to me when I was 13 years old, I still don't have the answers as to why, because I never did figure out the planes, which company it was. And of course, two days later, the plane crashed, and 230 some people died.
I know exactly.
I mean, I cried for a week
about.
And a half.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about, precisely. And, I can share with you maybe that it is kind of a message like, see, you can see through time. It is possible. So the next time you're shown something, you'll believe me, right? That's kind of the message.
Yes. I thought that they were just learning, of course, looking back on it. But at the time, I mean, I struggled quite a bit. Regardless of what the premonition was, if I had enough information on it to be very precise, which I often was, I would share it with the individual, but I would make really sure that I was careful how I shared it with them. You know, you can't just walk up to someone and say, hey, guess what? I had a dream you're going to die.
Yeah.
I couldn't do that. And it's not right to do that. But what you can do at that age, and I did think about things like that, is how I would word it and what I would say to them and say, you know, I really care about you. I had this dream. And I would change the format in which I shared it. So as a young person, I was very cautious with all of those things. I mean, I shared information quite bluntly with my good friends, but if something came up that, quote, involved them, I would still be very, very gentle as I could. And even as an adult, you know, I still have those challenges. How do you share things with an individual that maybe knows nothing? I mean, for someone that doesn't know anything about me, that's maybe known me through work or some kind of situation along those lines. I mean, I had that come up in the last couple of years, and I've had a very...
Yeah. Work is a terrible place to share that stuff. I know people that have lost jobs because they've, you know, they've shared something with a coworker or worse, a supervisor, and you know, probably saved the supervisor's life. And yet it turned around and created such a schism between them and normal mortals that their employment didn't work out.
Mm-hmm. It's always in a learning process. You know, 13 or 30 or 60, it doesn't matter. It's constantly learning. I mean, anyone that says that they're psychic and they get it all and it's all put together, I mean, I just don't buy it. Because
I always worry about people that put psychic or intuitive on their business card. But let's go back now. In 1985, you made a decision to visit a friend in Vancouver, and leaving a small town and going to a very cosmopolitan city like Vancouver at the age of 19 is a big change. What happened first as you explored your new freedom in Vancouver?
Oh, my gosh. You know, freedom is just the perfect word. I mean, I felt completely lost in a sea of people. But what that did for me was it allowed me to sort of come out of my shell a little bit more and be more comfortable with who it was that, you know, who I am, who I was at that time. So, you know, it really made me come out of my shell and just feel more comfortable and just being in my own skin, really. I made new friends and was very eager to explore the city and that sort of thing and, you know, did the usual things that a 19-year-old does at the time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so for the next couple of years, that was just my focus, is just going out and meeting people and having fun.
So in this fun mode, were you productive, or did you just hang out with your friends, and or did you have a job, or?
I worked, but I was completely, you know, non-productive, as meaning, you know, I wasn't going to school at the time. I was I was just focused on myself, working full time, and going out, and, you know, going out to the club scene and that sort of thing. That's all that I did. I didn't really do much of anything else.
Gotcha. So a couple years later, in 1988, you laid down on the couch to take a nap, and something happened. Can you take us on that journey real quick?
Well, that was an amazing nap. I was tired and sat on the couch, literally sat down, put my head on the pillow, and immediately, there was no time in between, immediately, boof, I felt as though I was being pulled through a tunnel. And in this tunnel, it looked like stars, and there were objects all over, and I can't tell you what the objects were, but I was passing them. It was so quickly that I didn't even have time to look at them. And at the very end of this tunnel, there was a man and a woman waiting there to speak to me, and they had long white robes on. And they had a wonderful conversation with me, which I was very intensely listening to. And then I completely woke up and sat straight up off the couch and thought, well, what on earth was that? Couldn't remember a single word they said, but knew that something had just happened.
Now, were you affected by this dream? Did you have a residual emotion left over from this dream?
Oh, I was completely shaken to the core of my being after this. And what was interesting was I could not for the life of me remember what they said. However, what I did was I sat up, I walked into the bedroom, and I packed my things, and I left that home. Because at the time I was living with someone. And it wasn't until years later that I sort of looked at that situation and thought, wow, they must have told me to get out.
And you just woke up and got the message that morning. Well, anyway, somehow the dream, this very lucid dream that you had, it stayed with you. And in a very short time, this highway trip came up with your friend Sally's boyfriend and her sister going to drive back to Cranbrook,
yeah.
Right? And this is where something very amazing happened. And this is a long drive, by the way, across long, open, unpopulated areas of Canada. So tell us what happened on this trip.
Well, before I get into that, I just want to share with everyone that I have done everything I could possibly do to sort of protect my family from this book and anything that, you know, coming out of it. So this situation actually took place in northern British Columbia, but for the sake of writing the book, I talk about the drive from Cranbrook in southern British Columbia to Vancouver. So that's the setting.
Okay.
But regardless, as you said, there's very much open expanse, and you know there's not a lot of population there. So what happened was,
especially in the mid-80s.
Yes, absolutely. Very different back then as opposed to now. Well, interestingly enough, I called this friend of mine when I was leaving this situation that I was in, the home that I was in, and it wasn't a bad situation. It was just I just left. So I turned around, went to their home. About a week later, they decided to take a trip to Cranbrook. So, of course, they asked me if I wanted to go, and at the time, I was not working. I think I was out of work for a couple of months at that point, and I was still looking for a job. So, of course, I said yes. I went on the trip, saw my family, saw my friends back home, did what I was normally doing at that point. I was 22, you know, had gone out to one of the bars that night, drank a lot of alcohol, and we were going to be driving back to Vancouver. So I got into the car to come back to Vancouver. Now, we'd done this trip so many times in the past, so many times, and the trip took 13 hours every time, one way. The reason it took 13 hours was because normally we'd only have one driver, because myself and my girlfriend didn't have a license, and her boyfriend did. So he would always have to pull over on the side of the road to sleep for 3 hours. And in this particular trip, when I got back into the car to take our trip back to Vancouver, I was very hungover. And I'm so happy to see my friend's sister and her son coming with us, which meant that we wouldn't have to stop for the 3 hours to sleep because we were going to have 2 hours.
So you had two drivers.
Yes. Which is a key to this story. It's one of the little puzzle pieces, you know? Little tiny puzzle pieces. Regardless of what we're talking about, whether you're talking about alien contact or psychic ability, I don't really particularly like that word either. I always say that I'm sensitive.
Yeah, there you go. I like that word better too.
I don't ever say that I'm psychic. It doesn't resonate with me. So regardless of what it is that I'm ever talking about, I always take a look at the really small, fine details, and that's normally where I will find the most information, interestingly enough.
Mm-hmm.
So we're in the car, we're driving back to Vancouver, and I'm in the back seat of the car.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, I'm just not feeling well at all, and I'm trying to get some sleep. And I wake up after having another one of these extremely vivid, moving dreams. And it was the same man and woman that had come to visit me. So, of course, at this point, Yes. Perplexed beyond comprehension. I was just completely blown away.
You were ready for that, were you? You just were expecting to just take a nap. And the previous dream that you'd had was in 1988, right? That was a long time before.
No, those were both in 1988.
Oh, they were just a few months apart.
I believe that they were actually only a few weeks apart.
Uh-huh.
Yes. I had not, at that point in my life, my abilities were sort of, they would go up and come down, they'd pop in, pop out, they'd be around, they wouldn't be around, things would happen, you know, for a few years there. Probably because, of course, I wasn't, you know, I mean, I was, as I said, I was hanging out in clubs and not paying attention to my soul.
Right, you weren't taking care of yourself.
Right. I did have fun, though, but as young people do, but nothing out of the ordinary, I would say. So during this particular time, even though I had all of this really great wisdom, there were things that I still didn't understand. And having this man and woman come to me in the dream when I laid down on the couch was just mind-blowing. And, I mean, I just went and tried to talk to a couple of people about it, one of them being a really good friend of mine, and she was trying to tell me that she thought that they were my, quote, guides. And I thought, well, what on earth are guides? You know, I didn't even understand that at that point. So when they came back to me in this vision again, this dream, I would say it's more of a vision because of the way that it presents itself, in the back of the car, sleeping on the highway, I mean, I was just blown away. I woke up just shaking. I was literally shaking. And
did they tell you anything in this dream?
They told me, they said, do not be afraid. We are coming for you soon. We are your friends. We are your family. Do not be afraid.
Wow.
And there was, I remember that it looked like a full moon behind them. I don't know what that was to this day, but I just remember the image of a full moon behind them as they spoke to me.
Ah. Now, did you share any of this dreaming with the others that were in the car with you on this trip?
No, not a word, because I knew that they would think I was nuts. I thought that there's no way. What would I have told them anyway? That I had a dream? There was nothing really to tell them. And, yeah, so, you know,
were there other strange things happening in the car? Were there strange things happening with the radio? Or were there strange lights or anything going on?
Well, from that point forward, I woke up, and probably within a few minutes, the driver, you know, wanted a break. So myself and the other woman went from the back to the front of the car, and, you know, we basically just switched drivers and passenger. So I was now sitting in the front passenger seat, and the other woman was driving. So we take off. We didn't stop or anything like that. We just stopped long enough to switch out drivers, and off we went. And within probably, you know, 10 minutes, you know, it was getting really dark out. It was late. I think it was about 11 o'clock at night, somewhere in there. And right away, these lights came up behind us. They looked like large, round lights that, looking at it rationally and logically, they looked like big truck lights, but they were slightly bigger and slightly higher off the ground, and that's why I thought that they were truck lights.
Mm.
So they would come up behind us rather quickly, and I would always think that they were going to pass us, and for some reason they never did. Whenever a car would crest a hill, or if they would come, a car would start rounding a corner, and we'd see the lights up ahead, these, quote, truck lights behind us would fall back. And what we noticed after some time of this happening, because it went on for hours and hours, that every time that the lights would be up behind us, there would be a strange radio station on that was from the Four Corners area. It was from the southwest.
And you were in Canada?
We were in northern Canada at that time. Yes, we were.
Wow.
We were in Canada, where at that point, you know, there was no such thing as satellite radio. We could barely get a radio station up there, and we had no tape deck back then in the car, so we had the radio on low, and then if we happened to pick up a radio station, we would turn it back up. So that's why we kept getting this strange radio station every time the lights would come up. And I believe that it was Albuquerque. I'm pretty sure that it was Albuquerque or Santa Fe that the transmission was coming out of.
That's very strange. Now, the woman that was driving, did she notice the lights, and did she notice the strange radio behavior?
Yes, she did. And we were, of course, talking about it. We didn't right away. You know, there was no reason to. But after this went on for, you know, 45 minutes or however long, we started to comment on it. And every time we would go through a town where there were people, or pass a house with that's, you know, on the side of the highway where there was lights on, these lights behind us would just fade back and disappear. And then, poof, they'd be back again. So this went on for hours. And eventually,
wow,
we were both getting very, very nervous. We were getting excessively nervous, saying, you know, what's going on? Why aren't they passing us? Why have they been following us for so long? At some point, you know, we would slow down to see if they would pass us, and they wouldn't. We tried to speed up when the lights would be gone to try and give space between us and what we thought was this other vehicle behind us, and it didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
So it just got to be more and more and more often that they would appear and disappear, meaning that they
now,
were
the two of you commenting on the lights? Who was the first to say, hey, maybe it's a UFO?
The woman driving, actually, what happened was she said to me, we went through a big town, and there was no way that this, quote, vehicle could have kept up with us. And so as soon as we got out of town and we were basically in forested area again, the lights started to appear and disappear really quickly, like literally in the blink of an eye. And she said, maybe it's a UFO. And I thought, what on earth are you talking about? You know, I didn't even know what a UFO was. You know, I didn't know what it stood for, but I knew.
That's right. Close Encounters of the Third Kind had not come out yet.
I don't know if it had or not. I think it was around that time, but, you know,
very,
I didn't understand really the full, idea of what she was saying by that. So she said, maybe it's a UFO, and I got really scared.
Oh, so
and
you
then,
had some fear.
Oh, yeah.
Or were you following the advice left to you by the aliens in the dream while you were sleeping before?
Not at all, because I hadn't even put it together yet, because I wasn't thinking about them or the dream or anything else at that point. At that point, I'm sitting in the car in the front seat, absolutely going crazy, saying, "My God, what's going on?" And then these lights, literally, you know, like blinking on and off, like turning a light switch on and off. And this went on for, you know, not very long. It was rather quickly at that point, once she said maybe it's a UFO. And then quite rapidly after that, I told her, I started screaming at her to pull over the car. And she really did not want to do that, and she was very angry at me and screaming and, you know, saying lots of bad
things. And everybody in the car woke up, and so the two of you are yelling at each other. You're wanting the car to pull over. She's going, are you crazy? You know, these are predatory lights. They're after us in the middle of nowhere. All these two women up here in the front of the car. Well,
yeah.
Your gift of telepathic communication was fairly well developed by now. What messages were you receiving from the aliens while this was going on?
Well, I didn't, you know, this is funny because I didn't really receive anything at that point, or at least I didn't think that I had. I didn't, I wasn't even aware of what was going on. I was just so freaked out by the lights.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, I yelled at her. I said, pull over the bleep, bleep, bleep car. It's not you they want. It's me.
Uh-huh.
And then I thought,
could you believe the words coming out of your mouth?
I was in shock. It was like I was pulled apart, you know. I mean, part of me was nervous. Part of me was calm. Part of me was not knowing what was happening. Part of me was yelling things at this woman to pull over that, what do I mean it's me they want? So I don't know if maybe in my mind at some point, you know, it all came together, or whether that was complete telepathic communication or what was going on, I'm not sure. But I did yell at her and tell her to pull over the car, and I went to grab for the steering wheel, and she sort of looked like a zombie in that moment as the car filled with light. I mean, filled with light. And
nobody
woke up, and
she was like in a zombie state.
They were all in a zombie state at that particular point. When the light came into the car, everyone was in a zombie state. It was actually,
wow.
The way that I describe it is, it was as if they were in suspended animation.
And the car did pull over safely and stop.
Yes. And then, life changed. Then the world changed.
You said in your book that when they asked you to get out of the car, you did so without resistance, and that you had lost all free will. Why did you write that in your book?
Because part of me understood why I was there, but part of me did not. And
mm-hmm.
I would say that the greater part of me did not understand why I was standing where I was and why I was doing what I was. And it was a conversation in my mind saying, okay, get out of the car, and then thinking, well, what do you mean get out of the car? Why am I getting out of the car? And there was no answer. What happened to me in those moments was really difficult to write about, and there was a lot more going on in those moments than I could have possibly have written on the pages of that book.
I reckon. I was reading between the lines, Miriam, and I got a lot out of that encounter. I was in the car with you while you were writing this in the book. I was right there with you reading it, and oh my gosh, the force that was in that car, the attractiveness, the light, the awakening, this ascension experience that you had, I want you to share as much as you can of those moments.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, thank you for asking me, and I'm really happy to hear that you did read between the lines, because of course a lot of the book requires the reader do so, because it was difficult. It's such a difficult story to express and explain. Now, as I'm sitting in the car, I'm going to go back to sitting in the car, okay? And I'm in the passenger front seat, and I have my hand on the back of the seat that I'm sitting in, and I'm staring, mesmerized by these lights that are behind the bumper now of the car, these ones that have been following. And I realize how large they are at that point. And so I'm taking in all of these little bites of information, and there seems to be light above me somehow, sort of filtering into the car, and, you know, I'm shocked and mystified by what's happening, and I'm thinking, wow, you know, what is going on here? And at the same time feeling very calm and just crazy at the same time. The people in the car are, it didn't even look like they were breathing. It was so odd. And I wanted to focus on that for a moment, but I couldn't. I had to turn around. And when I turned to the front of the car to see that this great light was shining at me, I saw a craft sitting on the highway, on the road of the highway. And it was so intense, the light, that it was almost as though I could not look at it. but it did not hurt me or harm me in any way. And at that point, that's when I started hearing, you know, conversation in my mind saying, get out of the car. Get out of the car now. And I thought, well, you know, I watched myself. I literally watched my hand reach for the car door handle. And at the same time, this little bit of a struggle saying, whoa, wait a minute. What is going on here? You know, this isn't making sense to me. That's all I kept thinking. This isn't making sense. What's really happening here? It was just confusion more than anything else. You know, I've had more fear watching, you know, a horror movie, which I watched only a couple in my life because they just scare me so badly. This experience was not a fear that was like that for me. It was a fear of what is going on. It's impossible for me to explain fully. I don't know. I mean, I don't know what I could say that would help someone to understand what exactly happened to me in that moment. So I'm reaching for the car handle. I step out of the car. They tell me to close the door. I close the door. I'm like, wait, what am I doing here? I don't understand. And then these beings walk up to me. They're about 4 feet tall, and they have black eyes. Please not to be confused with, quote, the Greys. It's not who these beings were. They had round black eyes and were almost like childlike and playful. So they were quite different. And they take me by the hand, and at the same time, you know, they're all telling me, do not be afraid, do not be afraid. And then what's interesting is I'm thinking to myself, right, there's no reason to be afraid, because the man and woman that came to talk to me in my dreams, they told me not to be afraid. They're my friends. They're my family.
Mm-hmm.
So I did have that thought carried with me as I was walking with them.
Aha. So in other words, there were two crafts there, and there were six beings that came out. They took you by the hand very gently, kind of leading you, not pulling you. And you went into one of the crafts with them.
I went into the larger craft that was on the left-hand side of the road, and before I even got there, there was a man and woman, a male and female, standing at this open doorway, and I was thinking, what are you doing here? Can't you just leave me alone? So, you know, the same man and woman, I don't remember, you know, I don't have that clarity of that. All I know is that I recognize them.
Mm-hmm.
So they took me by the hand and, you know, led me to the doorway, these small beings did, and then let go of my hand, and I walked on board the craft. I wasn't struggling and fighting, but I wasn't screaming for them to stop. I wasn't saying, what are you doing? I don't want to go with you. Stop. It was just, oh, man.
You remember walking in the craft? What was the atmosphere like in the craft?
It seemed to be surreal. You know, the way that the people in the car were in a sort of suspended animation, it was as though I was walking into air. Oh my gosh, this is going to get into something completely different. All my life I've been able to see air, and I'm sure that many of your listeners will relate to this. I don't see it all the time, but air has little tiny molecules. And every once in a while, I can see the molecules, and that's when, you know, people talk about auras and things like that. That's what you're actually seeing. Well, I've always been able to see, quote, air. Well, in this particular atmosphere, it was as though the air that I've always been able to see all my life was amplified, so it was just clearer. Everything was clearer inside the craft, and it was very bright. It was very white, as though it was, there was a soft hue of white light, but at the same time it was very strong. It seemed to penetrate through everything. And for whatever reason, the craft almost appeared to be alive to me. It didn't appear to be just a craft, it appeared to be almost alive.
Uh-huh.
It was very,
very fascinating. Very fascinating. Now, I don't want to spend a whole lot of time inside the craft because you have a much more important message to share, and we're nearing the top of the first hour, but you did mention that your feet were left wet after the experience in the craft. Why do you think your feet were wet?
Oh, my feet were wet because I had, when I walked up the hill to go to the craft, I had my shoes on. And it was, of course, wet grass that I had to walk through. So my shoes were wet, and it was wet from the grass. And they wanted me to get back into the car and put my shoes in the back and leave them there so that I didn't, quote, I couldn't remember right away and notice that my shoes were wet. Because if I'd done that, then I would have had proof almost for the people in the car as far as what it was that happened. Because of course they were sleeping throughout the entire incident. And so to finish it off, when I went back to the car, they woke up, and of course the gentleman that was driving was just mad, jumping up and down mad, because he said, if you didn't want to drive anymore, why didn't you just tell me? Instead of turning off the engine so that it's so cold in here, and it was just freezing in the car.
Oh, so you weren't gone just a few minutes. You were gone some time.
Yes. We were gone, And we finished it off.
And it would have been dangerous to leave the car there running because that would have asphyxiated everyone. So they did the safe thing, I think.
Yes.
Very fascinating. So the conversation when you got back to the car did not go well. I mean, the male driver was in the back seat, and he was frustrated, and the female driver who was still behind the wheel had no idea why she'd turned the car off and why it was cold.
No, and everyone was baffled and confused, and you know, it was just really confusing few minutes after we got back in, after I got back into the car. And I went into the back seat. Of course, we switched up drivers again. And he pulled out, and when he pulled out to the left, there were all of these glowing eyes, you know, as this deer in the, you know, deer in the headlights.
Mm-hmm,
and I kept trying to say, no, 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 it's not deer. Look at them. Look at them. Can't you see them? Can't you see them? And of course, nobody could. All they saw were deer on the side of the road. So these are what we call screen memories, memories that are given to individuals so that they don't have difficulty in processing what it was that actually took place. Because believe you me, people like myself can say whatever they want. Oh, I'm a contactee. I've been a contactee all my life. It's really, you know, it's just such a wonderful thing, and it's easy to deal with. It's not easy to deal with. It's not an easy thing to deal with. And, you know, in today's society, when we're looked upon as being irrational or making up stories or having wild imaginations, it's not easy to deal with. It's actually the opposite. So regardless of what happens, I believe it is often in our best interest. It is something that needs to be questioned as far as, quote, what group you have contact with, what it is that they're doing, know what the real purpose and outcome is, and then really assess it from the viewpoint of, okay, is this harmful or hurtful to me as an individual, and did they do some of these things in order to help me and protect me while still taking care of this great cosmic plan that we're all a part of?
And we're going to talk a lot more about that plan when we come back. Right after these messages, we'll take about 4 or 5 minute break, and we'll be right back. Don't go away. This is X Squared Radio. We have 2 more hours to go. Welcome back to X Squared Radio. We're beginning hour two. My guest is Miriam Delicato, and her book is Blue Star, Fulfilling Prophecy. She has a website, alienbluestar.com. We want you to visit that while you're listening live or while you're working at your workstation on your favorite project. Don't forget about it. We want you to pay close attention because there's a lot going on here tonight. We want you to pay close attention to it. In the news, the average temperature across both the contiguous U.S. and the globe during climatological winter 2007-2008 was the coldest since 2001, according to NASA scientists, or NOAA, National Climatic Center, in Asheville, North Carolina. In terms of winter precipitation, Pacific storms, bringing heavy precipitation to large parts of the West, produced high snowpack that will provide welcome runoff this spring. I just got done flying over three-quarters of the country, and I can tell you, almost every square foot of it at this moment is white. During January alone, 170 inches of snow fell to the Alta ski area near Salt Lake City, Utah, more than twice the normal amount for the month, eclipsing the previous record of 168 inches that fell in 1967. At the end of February, seasonal precipitation for the 2008 water year, which began October 1st, 2007, was well above average over much of the West. And I can tell you from my work out there in Washington State, it is very welcome at this moment. Also, our friends down at NRG Resources have been busy. In the world of engine lubrication, one product has risen to the head of the pack by far. I don't know if you know how lubrication products are tested, but ANSI has a standard test where they take a little bit of the lubricant, rub it on a smooth shaft, and then they put a bar against that shaft with a weight on it, and then they spin the shaft and they time how long it takes for that lubricant to fail. Most lubricants fail before 10 minutes. Some go a little bit longer. The reason this is called TVT 24/7 is that this lubricant went 24 hours and still did not fail. It is the new environmentally safe engine oil energizer that stops engine and transaxle wear. Users of the product report better mileage and a drastic reduction in engine maintenance. I'll tell you this, the Russian railroad uses it, and when people make mistakes specifying a lubrication product for that nation's largest employer, they pay with more than a loss of job. You know it's the best. Pick up a bottle at the online store at x2-radio.com and get it down that valve cover today. Our guest is Miriam Delicato. Her book is Blue Star, and her website is alienbluestar.com. Miriam, we were talking about your experience that you recalled, and this is much after your first contact with the aliens, the tall blonde aliens, but it's the first one that you actually had while awake and while you remembered it as an adult. And yes, things in your life really began to change after this. You started to meditate right after this night. Did anyone show you how to meditate? Were you trained by anyone, or you just started meditating on your own in a certain way?
Well, when I came back from this experience, the very next day I started meditating, and no one had ever explained anything to me. The process that I used in order to get into a meditative state was actually taught to me by these beings through telepathy. So an interesting side note to this phenomenon. It appears that when people have physical contact, And I'd like to stress this point with the listeners, because in recent years, this has become, in my opinion, the lines have not been clear. The physical contact that people have is not the same as astral contact, which is an entirely different subject, okay? But when people have physical contact, one-on-one, like as if we were to meet in person, okay, that's physical contact. That's not laying in a bed at night and getting taken. That's none of that business. Physical contact, they seem to have a residual effect, which is heightened sensitivities, psychic abilities beyond anything that they ever had in the past. They also seem to have a great deal of knowledge that all of a sudden is given to them within their own minds. And they seem to have telepathic communication with these beings for a certain period of time after that event, after a physical encounter. So those things are really important, because this telepathic communication that I had with them is really how, you know, at times I would learn to meditate. They would just simply sit there and tell me, get comfortable. So I would get comfortable in whatever position I chose and close your eyes. And they would tell me to take some breaths and breathe and focus in on their voice, or focus in on a molecule or a color, all sorts of different things. And then all of a sudden I'd be out of my body. And I've had these astral, I had so many beautiful astral experiences at that time. It was amazing. And
now, your life, your mortal life, now that you're in connection in 3D with these beings, and now you're having mature conversation with them. These aren't masked memories. They didn't block out this experience with you. They left it live in your memory. Did you have any marks on your body or anything like that when you came back into the car?
The following, that night when I went to take, when we got back to the apartment, when I went to change my clothes, I noticed that there was a red mark in my upper abdomen area on the right-hand side. It looked like a needle mark, a big needle mark of some kind. But I heard them say to me, don't look at that. Don't worry about it. It'll go away. And so I did. And, you know, that's one thing that sort of disturbs people even today when I tell them about that. It doesn't disturb me at all. It doesn't disturb me at all. I mean, when you understand how and why on a level that is so deeply profound, you don't quiver about small things. They're meaningless to me. I mean, if they did something to me and I don't remember it fully, which I don't consciously remember it, I'm sure if I were to be hypnotized, I would be able to bring back that memory. But everything that I write about in the book, and all of the memories that I talk about, at least up to this point, have come from, you know, conscious memory. That was immediately after the incident. So I could go back and take a look at that, I'm sure, to find out what it is that they did and why they did it. But, you know, maybe it's best that I don't know. Maybe it's part of a cosmic plan because of some of the other things that they told me. I trust them. I trust that they have our best interest at heart, and I do not feel fear from them in the sense of that they're here to harm us in any way. I feel that they are here to protect us and help us and guide us through this life.
Well, some of the things did come back to you, though, about your previous contacts with them, which were, up until this time, blocked out, like your contact when you were 5 years old or your further contact when you were 9 years old. Can you tell us a little bit about what, in these meditative states, they restored to your memory or allowed you to remember so that you could sort of put all the pieces together and figure out who you were?
Well, Wow. You know, right afterwards, sort of things started to seep back into my conscious mind. And the most compelling were when I was 9 years old, 9 or 10 years old. I couldn't quite figure out when and that exactly was, 9 or 10 years old. And then again when I was about 16 years old, those two incidents. Now, with those two particular incidents, what happened was I'd always had clear memories throughout my entire life of these strange moments. And in both of them, it was just a little bit of a tidbit of a memory of something that did not quite seem to, quote, fit into the norm of what reality should be. For example, you know, four members of my family all had the same dream that we saw a UFO in the backyard on the same night. We dreamt that. That was a memory that always stayed with me. So, of course, after this incident in 1988, that memory came back to me. I'm like, oh, okay, I must have been taken or something. Something must have happened, because there was also residual effect from that, where there was fear in that particular incident of being scared of people with big eyes after that. I was really terrified of them. And when I was 16 years old, I remember seeing meteors that traveled parallel to the Earth rather than shooting straight down and things like that. The one incident that, you know, out of everything that I could possibly tell you, the most profound for me, one of the top most profound memories, incidents, and pieces of this great puzzle that I'm a part of living, is this incident that took place when I was about 4 or 5 years old. And the reason for that was this memory came back into my mind of me being taken by them at that age. And it was a very specific memory, and it involved my older sister, who's 4 years older than I am. And it was crystal clear to me, exact detail of what took place. And I was, you know, taken, I woke up in the middle of the night, and I just wanted to, I was supposed to leave the house. I don't have any bad, scary memories of anything. I just woke up and knew I had to go outside. Mm-hmm. My older sister tried to stop me, and we end up going out into a farmer's field and standing there side by side. And above an old barn, there was a huge light. That's all I remember. I don't remember any detail or anything, just light. And I was standing there, and an orb, a round ball of light, came shooting at us from this craft, I guess, that was across the field. And it sort of scanned me and scanned my sister and then, you know, scanned her again and sent a blue beam of light into her head, and off she went back to the house, and I went with them. And so pieces of that started to come back to me. And for myself, you know, for years and years and years after, I was still struggling with whether or not this was a reality or still part of maybe some sort of memory that had come back to me that was not quite real. Because initially when I talked to my sister, I said, do you remember anything? The first comment that she said was, yes, I remember a light over the old barn. That's all she remembered. Mm. And this went on for years. We played a cat and mouse game with this memory. The next time I would ask her about it, I would say, do you remember anything strange? And she would say, no. And I'd say, do you remember the light over the barn? Because that's how far she had taken me in the past. And she said, no, I don't know what you're talking about. And then, you know, a couple of years later, I'd ask her again. It was similar. She would say, yes, I remember the light. And then she would add a detail. Oh, we woke up in the middle of the night. So it was interesting. She would either remember and then add a piece, in other words, add another step to what it was that took place with us.
Right, right.
Or she would not remember at all. But I never, ever gave her any of the details of this particular incident. And that happened in, you know, I asked her about it, I believe it was 1990. And that's when I asked her about it. And it took until 2000 and 5, I think, until she finally put it all together and wrote it out and had all of the pieces of the memory. And when she did, she wrote a story about it in great detail, and I mean exacting detail of what it was that I remembered.
Yeah.
And at the very end of this story that she'd, quote, written out, she hadn't finished putting it on paper, so she verbally told me. And I laughed, and I said to her, well, finally, maybe if you wrote it down this time, you won't forget. She had no memory of never being able to remember.
Mm-hmm.
So a couple of weeks later, I phoned her, and I said, okay, did you finish writing it out? And I said, well, now read it to me. I'd like to hear it now that you've written it out. And during that little piece of time, she forgot the absolute final piece, which was the blue beam of light, you know, sending light into her head. So verbally told me, and then 2 weeks later she finished writing it, and during that 2 weeks, for the last time, she forgot the last piece of the memory. Are you following me? Am I getting confused?
Yeah.
So she, I don't know if I asked her today if she'd remember or not, because I never know. What I do know.
Well, there was another event that happened that you write about in your book. You were given a gift, and you were told to bury it, and you buried it, and evidently while you were gone, your sister dug it up and moved it. So
yes.
It was kind of left that way in the book.
Which, by the way, she has great guilt over to this day, because I have gone back to her. She does. She's like, I'm so sorry. Oh, dear. The area in which I buried it has been disturbed, and so it is not as easy to find it. It's been bulldozed, actually. There's been bulldozers through the area. So I have gone back very briefly to try and find it, but if we're talking today, no, I have not found it. I have not found it as of today. Do I believe that it is there? With every single molecule of my body, I do. I do, because my sister has the exact same memory as me. People that live down the street have the same memory as me. A psychic incident that took place with a woman who did a reading for me, which I did not normally ever have done. Very rarely do I ever go to other people for things, but I was drawn to this one day, and this woman ended up pulling this memory of my being with these, tall blondes as a child.
Mm-hmm.
And so she confirmed again, a complete stranger giving me exacting detail, not just, oh, well, you were taken by them, and let's all get flighty and not really think about things too much. We're talking about exacting detail from so many sources. How could I, I say to people, how could I deny that? How could I toss that aside and say, well, I'm just going to ignore that piece of information? How can I walk away from that? So
Right. Although
I have not found it as of yet, I still believe with all my, everything that of who I am, that it's there and that it's just waiting for me to go back and find it, and that I will.
Have you ever asked the aliens to help you locate it since they gave it to you?
Yes, I have. And again, it's more complex than what you would imagine. I mean, having the picture that I draw of how I have many of these sensitivities and these different insights into life, you would assume that I would be easily be able to go out and, figure out the exact spot that I buried it or where it's been moved to with this bulldozer, if that's the case. But, that's not the way these abilities work. And even with
right.
the contact that I have today with these beings, if I sit down and go into a meditative state, for example, that is one of the ways that I can currently contact them. If I go into a meditative state and I contact them, we, as the channel, are only as clear as we as the human being are. So there's still a lot of room for mist to come in and not be clear. And also, you know, we're also dealing with, for myself, I'm dealing with my human, very human and very, my emotions. with my own not wanting to participate in something that is so great and so grand, and saying, well, can't I just play here on Earth? You know, can't I just be here and enjoy this beautiful planet like everybody else? Do I have to take part in this, you know, in this great big painting that's being done by in the cosmos? You know, so I still have to deal with that aspect of who it is that I am here today. And it colors things. And so it's not as easy for me to get that information. They have tried. I've had a few dreams about it. But the dreams are very scattered, and they're not crystal clear. And there are things that I believe within my soul and within my heart, more importantly, within my heart, there are reasons why I have not found it yet.
Mm-hmm.
And to get into any great detail with as far as why would not be, I don't feel that it would be in my best interest to share that with you.
Because I got you.
It would color things for me, and it would create more distraction rather than being able to focus in on it. However, I will say that in the past few months, I have had more people come forward to say that they would help me find it than ever before. So that's a good thing. Because when, you know, it's like saying, find a piece of clothing of yours, I don't know, if someone's lost a piece of jewelry that they wear every day of their life for 50 years, it's like trying to find your own skin. I mean, how do you do that, right?
Right, exactly.
You know, it's your own energy, so it's like trying to find yourself in yourself. And, you know, the energy around, for example, if it was someone else's jewelry that I had to find, it would be much easier because I'd be looking for something foreign, something that wasn't mine. I would be able to distinguish the difference between me and something else. So if I'm standing right on top of this object, and it's part of my energy, let's say, and I believe that it is, it's connected to me to that core level, those fine molecules of what makes up this great planet, then, you know, I could be standing right over top of it, but I'm not going to pick up on it because it's like saying, oh, well, you know, you just found your feet. They're there. You know, how do you do that? People question me on that quite a bit.
Well,
there are people who understand,
you know, people that are, well, let's just call them non-believers, or they're kind of locked up in 3D. They want physical proof. That's what they want. They're really tired of eyewitnesses, and they really want some physical proof. And the fact that you may have had an object that was given to you by them and you buried it, it's like, oh, gee, if we find this, you know, then we really have proof. But I think really that's probably why you haven't found it, because maybe it's not the physical object itself that we need to concentrate on. Now, I want to get back to some of what you saw while you were with the aliens. Did you see any other humans interacting with the aliens while you were with the aliens?
Again, interesting question. In the book, I don't write about seeing anyone.
Well, you say that you were in a ship and you were looking down on other humans, and you made the comment, gee, can I go down there with them? And they said, no, you're not mature enough yet.
Oh, this was when I was a child, yes, when I was 4 years old, sorry. I don't remember any humans being on that craft, but I do remember that we went to what I called a meeting. And there was all of these different crafts that were landing in one great big circle because I was allowed to walk around and look out the windows. And
wow.
So when I did that, I mean, I was 4 years old, right?
Mm-hmm.
I saw all these people coming out of different crafts, people, human beings, and there were a number of different beings that were coming out of these crafts. And I was told that one day I would be allowed to go to one of these gatherings, but not that particular day. That day I had to stay on the craft. I guess they were short on craft, and they needed to, you know, do what they needed to do with me as well as go to this meeting. I guess it was important. I really don't know. I don't have any details as far as what happened there. I just remember seeing them.
Mm-hmm.
There was probably
okay.
1, 2, 8 maybe more craft sitting there. It was a huge area. It was a huge open expanse and huge crafts, just massive crafts. But I don't know what was going on there.
Well, now what were the nature of the human beings that were there? Were they just average, you know, farmer policeman kind of adults, or were there military there? Were they interacting with the aliens, or were they kind of walking around like zombies? Or,
well, again, you know, looking at it from the perspective of a 4-year-old, right?
Mm-hmm.
Some of them had uniforms on. So when this memory came back to me, of course, later in life, in 1988-89, the memory appeared to be that these other people were military people. That's what the appearance was, that they were military people. But there was also just normal, average-looking people that were there. And, you know, I was kind of given the idea that they were gathering to talk about the world and what was happening in it and, you know, how things were going to progress. I'm not sure exactly who they were. I didn't recognize anyone. And I was 4 years old. I was just thought that it was really great to be able to see all these different crafts that were landing and watching them as they did some work on panels that they were sitting at and what they were doing there. And I didn't think about
cool.
it very much.
It sounds like aliens and humans were corroborating over something, and maybe the future, or maybe the current condition of the world or the planet. You know, some people have claimed that, well, that there are no abductions except by the government ships, and that they program people to think they've been taken by aliens to strike fear in the world and perhaps energize their campaigns to weaponize space. I don't particularly feel that way myself, but I've heard people say that.
I would love to be able to address that.
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
I have some very strong opinions on that.
We'll go ahead and talk about that, because, you know, a lot of people just don't think that aliens are out there, that all this is just
a facade.
Like mass hypnosis or whatever you want to call it.
Well, I would question whether or not those people are actually looking at the entire phenomenon. You know, when people say that to me, the first thing that comes into my mind is, oh, so the current governments are really the ones that were here thousands and thousands of years ago, who did all the petroglyphs all over the world about, you know, spacecrafts and space people and their petroglyphs all over the world. So that's ridiculous. So that's the first thing, is that these
right.
beings have been here for thousands upon thousands of years. That's the first thing. Secondly,
okay.
there are people all over the world, meaning there are spiritual people all over the world who have this great knowledge and have carried this knowledge for thousands of years. So, again, how can the government be a part of that? The idea of them taking part and abducting people, what I believe is happening is this, and I have to be really careful with what I'm going to say here. What I believe is this. The government, if it is, let's just say that this is the truth, that they are taking people and doing this, then I would say to you, okay, why would they want to weaponize outer space? Why? Is it because they like the current system that we have? And if my encounter is completely the truth and real, and these beings that I've had contact with, which I name the tall blondes because I don't have a specific star system that reform or their aura name.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if everything I say is the truth, and they are here to help guide us through our spiritual process, to help enlighten us, to basically just sort of stand at the sidelines, make sure that we don't destroy the planet, that we don't destroy ourselves completely, and so forth. If they are here to be kind, loving, and guide us, then if that is the truth, and the government is stepping in and actually is abducting people and saying it's all okay, now we're going to make everyone believe that it's all us. It's all us. Well, that would mean that if people did see these other beings, or the government is abducting people, making it think that all of these aliens, quote, are bad and evil, and that they're doing all these horrible things, then if my tall blondes show up, they will be stoned, you know, they'll be shot, they'll be, you know, people will have fear in their hearts over them. So,
well, one of the things that has been made known, at least on this program where other guests have come on and said, is, you know, anybody that can make a left-hand turn at 10,000 miles an hour and not be apprehended is a clear and present danger to our current military way of thinking. And so there is a faction in the world that believes that, you know, we own the skies of Earth, and no one on Earth or off Earth has the right to fly in them but us. And, you know, we really don't have anybody big and bad to fight anymore, and we want to maintain our military might, so we need to raise money so that we can fight an alien threat.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
mm-hmm.
kind of where all this is being led.
It is, and I think that it's something that needs to be talked about and debated openly without blinders on from either side, from my side or from the people that are talking. I think it would be a fascinating discussion to have someone like myself and then someone who is completely opposed saying, okay, we need to be able to fight them, and have us sit down and have a conversation. Because, you know, these beings that I currently have contact with, they say that they are protecting us not only from ourselves, but of forces that may not be known to us at this time. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So are we being threatened from somewhere else, and are they protecting us from that threat from elsewhere? Well, I do also know that there are beings out there who do not have our best interest at heart and who are technologically advanced and who do have a lot of this, quote, mind power over us. But to say that it's the government and that they're the ones that are doing it, to me, is just sheer stupidity on anyone's part. If that's the only thing that they believe, then I believe that they are just completely closed-minded and have no rational thinking. And I mean that, rational thinking. Rational thinking, if you sit down and pull it apart, cannot come to that conclusion.
I'm completely with you, completely. One of my good friends, Michal Ledwith, has just published a book called The Orb Project. And this remarkable phenomenon that has probably been, it's been the driver probably for more purchases of digital cameras than anything I could imagine. How did you become familiar with orbs?
Well, my orbs are not the same as the orbs that are showing up on digital cameras. Orbs that I talk about are completely different. So that needs to be said right up front. One of the things that I did was on my website I talked about the differences with some of these orbs. And I'm very, you know, I'm going to touch on something that I know people aren't going to like, and you might even debate me right here and now.
No, that's okay.
The orbs, okay, let's talk about the orbs that I talk about first of all. If you and I are sitting at poolside and we're having a nice barbecue and the sun's shining, we're relaxing, I'm going to look up and I'm going to see something in the sky. And I'm going to say to you, my God, look up, can you see that? And you're going to see exactly the same thing as me. So if I see a ball that looks like about the size of a softball floating in the sky, and then all of a sudden it's going to just stop and sit there and look at, you know, sit there and hover in the exact position with no sound whatsoever, and then all of a sudden move again, we're going to be seeing the same thing. That's an orb, and that's what I call it, just a round orb.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is the same as some of these sightings that are taking place in Mexico, where massive numbers of orbs, like hundreds of them, hundreds of balls, picture it, soft balls, go that are silverish in color normally, but they can be green or blue or red or whatever the color is, but I think most often they're seen as silverish. They go floating past in formation, meaning they don't, they're not like a bag that's been picked up by the wind or any other object that might be floating through, quote, air. They stay in formation of one another. These are the orbs that I'm talking about. So those are the round orbs. The other orbs that I talk about that I see are what I term star orbs. And the reason that I call them that is because if it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon and you and I are poolside again, I always talk about being at poolside because that's always where I want to be. if you're at poolside and you look up into the sky, it's a blue, beautiful blue sky, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, what you're going to see is a star sitting in the sky. And it's going to sit there for, you know, a minute or 2 minutes or 10 minutes. It's not going to move. And then all of a sudden it'll just start to go, you know, in a horizontal manner and start moving for, you know, 50 feet, and then it'll stop and it'll just sit there again. So that's what I call a star orb. So if 1,000 people were standing there, 1,000 people would look up into the sky and see the exact same thing, because they look like stars in the sky. And they're not that. They can be quite high up, or they can be really low to the ground. They can almost come right up to you if you allow them to. That's a star orb.
And this could even be during the daytime, right?
Yes. Yeah. 2 o'clock in the afternoon, 1 o'clock in the morning, any time of the day or night, you can see them.
Very interesting.
If you take a picture of them, they are going to be, they're going to show up in a couple of different ways. They're going to show up as a burn mark almost on your film if you are using not digital cameras, but regular film, 35 millimeter film.
Mm-hmm.
Old school here. Or if you take a picture, that's of the star orb, they can almost burn the film as if you're taking a picture of a super bright light. And again, I'm going to stress that this could be at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, taking a picture of a star orb in the sky, which is, of course, stars don't appear in the sky at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, do they?
Yeah, then, I've never heard of a star orb before. What do they look like?
Exactly like a star. Like, if you were to go out and look at the brightest star, well, depending on where you live, if you're in this city, you'd have to pick the brightest star that you see and then give it about tenfold.
Wow.
Or fivefold. If you
now,
do these
like flare up? Do they start kind of dim and then they flare up really, really bright and then they go back dim again and then move?
Yes, they can. Yes, they
can. I have seen one. I have seen one myself.
Wow.
I know exactly what you're talking about. I saw one in Washington State in 2006 in July. It did exactly what you just said. I witnessed it. I saw it.
Well, there you are, Brooke.
Oh, and this wasn't during the day. This was at night. But this thing flared up like I thought it was going to come down right on top of us. It actually lit the ground up. We could see our feet. It got so bright, and
really?
And a wave of fear. I got afraid. I went, it's coming down, and then it stopped, and it went back up, and it dimmed back down, and it took off in another direction.
So here's the thing.
I guess it picked up on my feelings.
Right. If you would not have had the fear, it may have stayed for another moment. Maybe, you know, I tell people when they see these things, they need to ask them, do you have a message for me? Sometimes they might have messages, and they do. They'll give you a message.
Okay, I'm going to do that next time. But this
okay.
was my first time.
Well, that's great.
It took me by surprise.
That means that they know that you're there, and that they're there to participate whenever you're ready. Now, if you start asking for them tomorrow, it doesn't mean they come around, because I ask for them every day. It doesn't mean I get them to come around every day. I'm ready.
I know I say that all the time, every day. So do you think they come from other dimensions?
When they are like that, you know, when was it, last year? Oh, last summer in August, I was down in the Four Corners area, and I saw one of these star, what I call star orbs, and it was quite bright. And it was really fascinating for me to watch because, of course, you know, I tell this to people as well. I don't have all of the answers to every little detail. I don't have those answers. So, you know, some people get really irritated at that and they want more and more and more. Well, I'm also in the process of learning, so I'm sorry to those people that would prefer me to have the knowledge of everything, but it's not quite possible for anyone. Now, I was traveling along, and I saw one of these, quote, star orbs, and it was parallel to the Earth. It was quite close, actually. And when I saw it, I was like, oh, initially, I thought it was a plane. I don't know why I thought that, because it, you know, was not even in the right position for anything. But that's how the rational mind will try to sort of overcome the irrational. It will try and find a reason. So I kind of blinked again, and then I realized, oh, wait a minute, this is not right. This is, you know, 10 o'clock in the morning. It's not a plane, and it's certainly not a star, and that's not traveling right. And I was mesmerized by it, and it was very, very bright. And what happened was I was going to tell my friend, and at that exact moment, it was as though it turned direction. So instead of going, in my view, from my left to right, it then started to go turn, it turned left, so it was going to go away from me.
Mm-hmm.
And as it was doing that, it appeared to turn, and it blended, half of it had blended into the sky, and half of it was still, quote, this bright star. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So it was kind of multi-dimensional, like it was a plasma ship or something.
Right. So was it coming from another dimension? Maybe. I believe, you know, I don't know. Do they have the ability to come from other dimensions? I believe they do. I believe that these beings come from different time, space. They are physical. They are within our dreams, that they are on so many different levels, and yet they are all connected. It's the same way, I describe it this way. It's the same as you and I going to sleep at night and we have a dream. You know, we question all the time whether or not we live in other dimensions and whether we're going to go on. In my understanding, from what I believe that when I go to sleep at night, I go to another world. That's my belief. I believe I go to another world.
Do you always go to the same place when you meditate, when you dream, when you have these out-of-body experiences? Do you start out at the same place every time and then take off from there?
No.
There is one
place in particular where these beings, especially right after the 88 encounter, that they took me on a number of occasions. They did take me to a particular spot on a number of occasions, yes. And it was the most beautiful spot I have ever seen, ever, in any of my visions or dreams or meditations or real life. It's just beautiful. And it had a creek almost that was running, you know, running water, and a little bridge that was there, and a big log that we used to sit on, and green grass. It was just beautiful, just beautiful. And there was a huge mountain. Now, this mountain that I saw, it was as if the mountain was the universe. It was so large. I definitely had some experiences there. Wow.
I think we have a caller on the line. Caller, your first name and where you're calling from, please.
Well, this is Ann Codd from Northern
Ireland. Hi, Ann. How are you today?
Hey, finally got you. I wanted to just ask you or your guests if they remembered Ruth Montgomery, who wrote a lot of books years ago. And one, she mentioned a planet that the sentient beings were orbs. Does she remember that?
I've never read a book by Bruce Montgomery. Have you, Miriam?
You know,
she wrote Aliens Amongst Us and all kinds of other things. She was a secretary in Washington for years and then began to hear things, so she wrote books. Anyway, I just wondered... one of the things is that if you look at these orbs that are in the pictures, you know, that people take, I've seen no end of them, and from all kinds of areas, some from a walk-in that was over in Egypt, and she showed me pictures of them. If you focus on them with sort of half-closed eyes, sometimes you could see a face in those orbs that are taken. There's a different thing that your guest is talking about, I understand, but...
Oh, sure, I've seen that before. I've seen faces in orbs before, sure. But
yeah.
These are photographed orbs. What we're talking about and what we had a common experience with are visible orbs that you see with your naked eye. And they react to your emotions.
Yeah, I understand that. Yeah.
Ruth Montgomery was actually a pioneer in all of this, in ufology. And
yes,
when I had my experience in 1988, she was one of the books that I did find. I have a vague recollection of reading one of her books. I can't tell you which one it was, but I know that I did initially find her book, and I was very grateful for it because it was one of the only connections that I had to anyone, anywhere that had any kind of knowledge about UFOs or aliens. For at least the first 9 months of my experience.
Oh,
and,
boy.
That
was
so
amazing. She wrote one, Aliens Amongst Us, and she had a different chapter for each person who had had arrangements, soul arrangements with people, so that they allowed people to walk into their physical body when they left it. And one of the people was... a man in, his name was Bjorn Ortenbein, and so there was an address, and I wrote to him, so it was real, and he wrote back, and anyway, very interesting story. If you have a chance to pick up that book, Aliens Amongst Us, you'd really enjoy it.
Thank you so much for sharing that with me, and now that you've said, you know, the couple of things that you have about the orbs, I might just have to go and take a peek at it again to see if we're similar.
Yeah,
it sounds as though they have
some gatherings now called Prophets Conferences, and the last one I think was held in Sedona, and the guest speaker, his subject was the orbs. I couldn't go to it, but I bet it was interesting. Okay, I won't go any longer. I just wanted to say, good to hear your voice, Brooke.
Do you think that they're craft, or do you think they're actually beings?
I think they're beings, those. Yeah, I think those are beings. I don't know about the ones you're seeing, but could be either. Anyway.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We appreciate you calling in, and you can call back anytime.
Well, this is the first time I've been able to get you for ages. I was way too long. Anyway, are you doing all right?
Yes, everything is going fine, yeah. We're... just about finished with the biodiesel plant up in Washington, and
that's great.
We've
set
our sights for 2009 for the Inner Earth Expedition.
Yeah, I told you I got a DVD on the Inner Earth by Sheldon Neidel, which is quite extraordinary. I wish you could get it just to have a look at it, because he really goes into detail.
I will look for it. I'll pick it up.
Okay. Bye bye.
Bye bye. All right, Miriam, you've been able to draw other people, as you said, a poolside in your book, into seeing one of the orbs, but it's difficult to get people to actually admit in public that they've seen it. It's difficult for them to say, you know, once they've seen it with you or seen it with me, to actually come out, you know, with other people and say, yes, I was there, I witnessed it as well. We recently had a governor who denied seeing a UFO and then, you know, some years later said, okay, I really did see the UFO.
Yeah.
How difficult is it to get people, you know, to actually open their eyes and see what you see?
I don't believe that it's as difficult to get someone to be able to see things as it is, as you said, for them to come forward.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, it's such a complex subject matter. And unfortunately, in today's society, in the way that things are set up, sadly, people like myself get ridiculed. And
sure.
It depends
not
on
so
how much
now,
much
though.
Back
in 1990,
yes.
Maybe. Really, even now?
Oh, yes. I mean, to say that we don't have anything happening with us is, you know, I don't even know what to say to that because, you know, for myself, I've been out with my friends since 1988. I've been upfront and honest with my family right from 1988. And by the way, my family fully supports me. My father's
mm-hmm.
concerned about my ridicule. But the rest of my family is very supportive of me coming forward.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as far as the rest of the world is concerned, I have not been, I have not come forward for a very long time. It's only been within the last, I would say, year that I have actually started to really tell almost everyone in my life about my experiences, and there's been reasons for that. However, you know, even now, I don't want to get into the detail too much, but I would have to say that my life has been negatively affected because of me coming forward in a way that would outrage you. And it's not a small incident. It's something that happened with me. There's no way of me turning things around because, you know, people are people. But we're talking about In today's society, I mean, if you're talking to friends, great. If you're talking with someone who is open-minded, fantastic. If you're going to a particular area and you're in casual conversation with someone and you have no connection to them, it's still fine for you to come forward. But in today's world, it does make it difficult for people like myself. And what frightens me as a person who's had all of these contacts is we all need to come forward. The people who have had direct physical contact all need to step out, you know, from the darkness into the light and come forward.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to be able to tell them, yes, do it. But I also need to tell them that you need to be prepared for that ridicule and for whatever consequences might come your way, because we never know how people are going to react to our stories and what it is that we're saying. I mean, yes, the world has greatly changed from 1988. It has changed so much because in 88, UFOs and aliens and the paranormal, sensitive, you know, people who were, quote, psychic, metaphysical, spiritual, into yoga, any of those things, that was not in everyday life. But now, today, it's on the TV. We, you know, we're all talking about it, regardless of whether or not someone considers themselves to be, you know, spiritual or not. They're still thinking about yoga and how the mind works and spiritual self or religious self or whatever it is that they're focusing in on. So it is a very different world. However, when it comes to this particular subject matter, people are still in fear. And I believe that it is because it is one of the last strongholds for us to break through in order for us to have a spiritual life.
Sure.
And when that's why there's so much resistance to it and so much fear. And also because the environment is created for us to have that fear. And again, that takes us right back into the government, people saying, oh yeah, it's all the government. And, you know, that's all fear-based. Or, well, there's bad aliens that are incarnating onto the planet all over, and they're the ones running things. Okay, well, even if that was true, it's irrelevant. All of that is irrelevant because one of the most important messages that these beings will, you know, have brought forward with myself and bring forward today is that we are here as spiritual beings on the planet and that we need to focus in on ourselves, not on anything outside of us. Within ourselves, within our heart, within our soul. And these are the things that will guide us to a more peaceful and spiritual life. There is nothing outside of me that someone else can show me. They can show me a path to follow. They can be my guide, but they cannot teach me, because the true teacher lies within all of us. And so that's one of the strongest messages, spiritual messages, that these beings have brought forward with me to sort of, you know, pass on to other people. We need to look at ourselves and question everything. And so when people are coming forward saying, oh, it's all the government, well, question that. If they're saying it's all aliens, question it. I don't care what it is. We need to question our reality around us as far as who we are as human beings, what our purpose is, why we're here. And if we can create an environment where if I raise my own spiritual level, if I can raise my own spiritual awareness, then I can touch the people around me. I cannot walk around trying to affect things outside of myself and think that that's spiritual enlightenment or spiritual
character. Well, let's talk a little bit about spirituality, or if you want to use a different word, we can call it different states of consciousness. Do you think that there are beings on this planet that are stratified into a broad range of states of consciousness?
Yes, I do.
And do you think that there's a gathering occurring at this time of like-minded souls, or souls with the able to achieve the same level of consciousness?
Yes, I do. 100%.
Now, when you recalled your interaction with the tall, blonde aliens in mortal life, in real life, in 3D life, after you had your 3D contact and all this recall came back, did you feel alone?
Oh, I felt very lonely. I felt very much alone. I felt isolated, and I'd never felt more isolated before in my life, because I understood that I was a part of something in a physical and non-physical way at the same time, that was far greater than the people around me could comprehend or understand at the time. So in that respect,
right,
I did feel quite alone.
And so did you seek out others? Did you seek out others who would understand what you had experienced?
Well, initially I tried desperately to find someone that would understand what it was that I was going through, and unfortunately I never found anyone for 9 months. And after that period of time, I did finally, you know, sort of hunt someone down through a magazine that I found, and I just, you know, finding her was just pure and utter ecstasy, because
mm-hmm.
I was so happy that I finally found someone that understood what it was that I was saying, talking about the concepts that I was bringing forward to her. She understood what I was talking about. And after that, I did, you know, start a group for people like myself, but it didn't last for very long, because I realized that it was sort of pointless at that time.
I gotcha.
But now, at this particular juncture in the reality that we're currently living in, you know, the gatherings are what is one of the focal points of these beings. They are asking for the gatherings to begin. And the gatherings are like-minded people.
We're going to talk about that and focus on that, the gathering, and maybe what this world has been through and what it's about to go through in our final hour. We'll be back after these messages. We're going to take about a 60-second break, and then we'll come back to live commercials and more with Miriam Delicato, author of Blue Star. Don't go away.
Brooks Agnew here with X Squared Radio. There is some place you should visit before the end of the week. The Horizon Project is probably the most important examination of future Earth events in the world today. But there is a reason you should visit their website soon. I can't give you all the details here, but I can tell you that the first DVD in the 6-part series is now available for pre-purchase with a $5 discount. This series will no doubt be airing on the History Channel or Discovery Channel, but you need the uncut version with all of the bonus material. Trust me, it may be one of the most important video productions you will ever see. Click on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio today. The space shuttle fleet is very soon going to be retired. No other spacecraft in history has advanced the world more than this fleet. I wanted a way to keep that memory alive in my home, so I went to the space store at X Squared Radio and ordered a 25-inch model of the space orbiter. People who have seen it always comment on the incredible attention to detail in this model. I think if you know someone who loves the space program, and you want to get them a gift that they will never forget, you should visit the space store at X Squared Radio.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. In here, the results are always positive. We're coming to you live from Western Kentucky, from deep beneath the earth. We should be back in Eastern Washington State before too long to finish up the biodiesel plant. Want to let you know, Volume 3 of the Ark of Millions of Years, Unlocking the Secret, is now at the publisher, should be out in print in about 3 weeks. We will let you know right here on this program so you can pick up the third volume if you already own the first two. And we're going to have a special on there so that you can pick up the entire trilogy, almost 2,000 pages, all nonfiction, about the end times, 2012, and Unlocking the Secret, learning how to work the law of attraction in very practical ways, much more useful than sticking a picture on your refrigerator and looking at it every time you go for a snack. You'll be able to get a lot more out of life. We'll keep you tuned in as to when that book is going to come out. Also want to let you know an update on the North Pole Inter-Earth Expedition. We have now set our sights on 2009. We had no idea that our 13-city tour with hundreds of thousands of people over the last year, as well as being on several national and international radio programs, would have the effect that it had on North Pole cruises. You all got so excited, you went out and booked up all the charter vessels that go to the North Pole. They only make 4 trips a year with the nuclear-powered icebreaker Yamal, and you all booked it up 2 months early, so we were unable to get our deposit in there and charter the ship to actually make our voyage. So we're setting our sights on 2009, and hopefully we will beat you to the charter company and get that ship chartered so we can get our scientific voyage out of the way. In any case, we do have a new producer on board, Emerald Films, and they will be handling all the documentary needs of the expedition. 15 days, the largest civilian expedition in history. Many are calling the greatest geological expedition of all time. We will be taking that to places not before seen by human eyes and be sampling the ocean floor 4,400 meters under the ice. We'll bring you back the information as to the true structure, the structure of the Earth, and hopefully it will be very entertaining for you. Come on, Everest has been climbed lots of times. We've been to the moon a few times, and this is a lot less expensive than going to Mars. Speaking of NASA, they may not be able to continue all its current science programs and pull off some bold new ones under a shrinking budget, according to U.S. politicians and scientists. We wonder what Obama's space policies are. It would seem that a pro-UFO disclosure policy would cinch the election, since 47% of Americans have actually seen one, and believe the government is holding back what it knows about them. I wonder if he's interested in adding that to his platform. And in some more news, and a little infomercial here, Alan Greenspan says we are in the worst financial shape since World War II. What does he mean by that? Well, in his article, We Will Never Have a Perfect Model of Risk, he says Wall Street is just waiting for the next domino to fall. We have told you this many times on this program. That's why we secured the best affiliate in North America to provide you what you need for survival without eating bugs and worms and drinking brackish water. Now get yourself to NitroPack. Click on that banner at x2-radio.com and start getting prepared. You're going to need some food storage that's easy to carry. You're going to need some light equipment to go with it and maybe a water filter. Trust me, this isn't going to be your average tornado. We're going to talk about that this hour with our guest, Miriam Delicato. Her book is Blue Star, and her website is alienbluestar.com. Now, I know tonight is Palm Sunday, and I know that many of you are enjoying that with your families, and that's fine. We appreciate that. This is the beginning of Holy Week. We want you to concentrate on the spirituality of the week and not the religiosity of the week. And if you're out there live right now and you would like to call in, you can do so toll-free anywhere in the U.S., 888-228-4494. And in Canada, we also have a toll-free number for you, 877-489-6350. Anywhere else on Earth, off Earth, if you can reach a cell phone tower, you can get to us, 530-776-5154 or 530-776-5185. Our final hour of a three-hour X-Squared Radio tonight, Palm Sunday. Miriam, let's talk about the relationships the aliens tried to describe to you between humans and the Earth. I read your book twice, and I made notes all through it, and I may page through it again after this interview. And there's a short section that just moved me deeply, and I wondered if I could have your permission to read it. It's on page 192.
Okay. I would ask that you only make one comment before you read that, okay?
Okay.
I tell people this before I have them read the back of the book.
Okay.
If you were to go to this book and read the entire last chapter, you will feel something from it. But it is only after you read the whole rest of the book, the first part, that I believe it brings the greatest strength to the last couple of chapters. So bear that in mind as you're reading them, because sometimes people say, well, who knows what that means. But it's when you read the whole thing. So go ahead. I would love for you to read from the book. Thank
All
you.
Right. It's a short paragraph, but this, I was starting to underline the whole thing, and then I went back and I just bracketed it. The Earth is a very special place because it is unlike any place or other dimensions, other planets, or in the universe. Here, we are given a gift of beauty in the form of being separated from everything that surrounds us. Instead of being in light bodies, we are dense and heavy here on Earth. We can enjoy the singularity of almost every molecule around us. For this reason, we are able to sit quietly and stare at a flower petal or an ant. We can watch and learn from it, if that is what we choose to do. We can see into the entire universe and become closer to God by looking closer at anything in nature, but only if we stop and open our eyes. That is, I think, the core of this book. We need to stop and open our eyes and realize something very important that you state in this book, that we are not alone.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the aliens told you that they were involved in the seeding of the earth, right?
Yes.
Now, many religionists would have us believe that there was only one being involved in making humans, and he is God, and the aliens aren't saying that they're gods, right?
Correct.
Okay, so it means that, like God is today, in my opinion, God doesn't do everything for us. He may lay commandments out there. He may lay guidelines out there. He tells us to love ourselves and love our neighbors, but he doesn't give us, you know, our menu for every day and what we're going to do for a living and what we're going to say and what we're going to do with our lives. That's up to us.
Right.
He leaves it up to the beings of the universe to follow through with his dream, with his guidelines. And maybe that's what the aliens were doing in their involvement with us. Now, how many human civilizations have lived here on Earth according to what the aliens taught you?
According to what it is that they've said, they've stated that there's been two civilizations, and this is the second one, that were
okay.
Human. But
and what happened to the first
they've
one?
They've said that there was four different worlds that existed, this one being the fourth one.
Okay.
So, you know, to give a really brief overview, they
uh-huh.
decided, we're going to seed Earth with life that would be spiritual. So they sort of waited for, you know, for life to spring forward in the first world, and nothing happened. The second world, they helped to create somewhat of a structure for a being. Nothing came of that. And then in the third world, they gave it more form. They gave it human form. But in this human form, there was also the knowledge. The knowledgeable part of who we are as human beings, where we came from, where we were going, just a great deal of spiritual knowledge. However, in this world, prior to this one, these beings, human beings, that is, their knowledge was so great that they understood that these forms that we currently live in were temporary. And that no matter what happened to the form, the body, that they would still go on being the sparks of God, okay?
Mm-hmm.
That the soul would still continue. Therefore, a lot of experimentation started happening, and human beings just started experimenting on ourselves, basically, and things got really out of hand, and it became quite gruesome and ugly, and the spiritual aspect of life was rapidly declining, and knowledge of, you know, how to travel off worlds and all sorts of things were going on. So there was a lot of knowledge that was in this last world. But it was like giving a child, you know, giving a 3-year-old the keys to the car. You know, they can go out and travel
mm-hmm.
around, but can they even reach the pedals? Do they know what they're doing when they're driving if they were to hit someone? No. So that's in this last world, things got out of hand. And it was sort of my understanding that it was so ugly and grotesque that it had to be stopped because it was getting to the point where the planet was at risk. And so it was a decision made not only by these beings, but by God, by of all things, the source of everything, that this other world would be sort of, you know, wiped clean. And in this other world, in the third world, they showed me some people that were living as was intended to live, as being spiritual beings, to learn to live in harmony with all things, and to spiritually grow with a greater and greater, greater understanding of God.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the entire purpose. Well, these people were taken off the planet in the third world. And then once things settled down, one might say, they were taken back to this earth and repopulated the earth. And those people are the indigenous people of the world today.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you think some of the remnants left behind, like maybe the pyramids or the Osirian or some of the work in Machu Picchu, you know, stuff that dates way, way, way back before what they claim are biblical times. Do you think these are remnants of these older civilizations that were here?
I do, actually. They showed me on the screen in 1988 when I was on board that craft. They showed me a screen. It's almost like a holographic screen that popped up in front of me. And as they were showing me things, I was getting more telepathic pictures in my mind from them and then some instruction and so forth. And they said that, they were here living in part with a little bit of coexistence during that time. But there were some interesting things that came out of that. Now, not necessarily about Machu Picchu, but about the pyramids. And I'm sure you'll find this fascinating. I don't know what year it was. I think it was somewhere around 1989 or 1990. There was this program that someone asked me if I wanted to go and, you know, just sit in the audience on. And it was all about the paranormal and on UFOs. So, of course, I went. Now, in order for me to get a ticket to this show, I had to call and talk to the producer, and because there were no tickets left. And I had, I think, an hour-long conversation because they were fascinated listening to me talk.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things, near the end of the conversation, I talked about the Great Pyramid of Giza. And I said, I didn't call it that. I called it the Great Pyramid, the Great Pyramid. That's all I called it, the Great Pyramid. And I said, made a comment to this producer, and they flipped on me. They just went crazy, wild. Wow, I can't believe this. This is so crazy. And they didn't even know what to think because three people had called them, and all of us had claimed that we had direct alien contact, and that all three of us had apparently said that we had knowledge about the Great Pyramid. And to take it a step further, we all said the exact same information. He said that it was almost the same wording that we used.
Oh, that's amazing.
So, as I drum roll for the information, which I've never ever shared, ever, until right now. Actually, shared with really close people, but I've never shared publicly. I was shown the Great Pyramid and told that it was very important in the last world, and that the Great Pyramid held sacred knowledge, and that underneath in one of the rooms of the Great Pyramid there was books of knowledge, and that in these books there were different technologies and things about our past and who we were and where we were going, and really the records of that world, and that there were instruments there that could in fact almost destroy the earth, that they were so powerful. And this room, I was told, this room was sealed off, and that they knew apparently that they would find it, meaning us as human beings, would find this room, but we would not know how to get to it. And if we went into this particular room in the wrong way, that it would collapse on itself and they would destroy everything in the room.
Wow, so someone with special knowledge, he has to know how to get in this room.
Yes, and so, you know, should I even say this over the airwaves? Why not? Some of my friends will say, what are you doing? But I actually have a picture of really, you know, just a simple sketch of the pyramid and exactly how the rooms are, one under the other, and the passageways that take you there.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting. So what's fascinating to me again, and I would have to stress this to everyone listening, is, you know, we can question about, quote, the government of today being a part of all of this, but is it the government today that built the pyramids and put this information there and had all three of us call into that producer and say the exact same thing? I think not. I think not.
I think, yeah, and for all of that to come together at the same time, in the same event,
yes,
is also maybe planned as well.
I believe in the grand picture, God's design. I know since the very beginning of this experience in 1988, people have asked me about God and what my feelings are, and I have the strongest belief in God than most people do. But when you question as far as what I believe God is, well, of course, God is everything. Because how can I say that there is one being that I would praise and love and cherish when that, even if that were true, then that one being created all of this, and should I not hold that in the greatest light? You know, God is in everything. God is in me as the human being. God is within the flower petal or the ant walking across the dirt and going to his own little space within the earth. God is within the sun and the moon and the stars. God is, but you know, what we forget is that God helped to create everything around us. And then we in turn became our own creators. And what it is that we create should be thought when we create these things, we should think about God. You know, what is it that we're creating? Are we creating wars? Are we creating, you know, a peaceful, loving earth that we can all coexist on? Are we destroying it with our fossil fuels, or are we trying to cherish the earth and love the earth and understand that we can live in great peace and harmony here? It's interesting when someone is so immersed in the material world, they are so completely immersed in it that they have no concept of anything or anyone outside of what it is that they're going to buy, build, or, you know, create for themselves. It's fascinating for me, from my perspective, to know that there are these other dimensions and existences around us at all times. Even as I'm sitting here on the phone with you, I know that right next to me could be a being, you know, that I don't necessarily see, or maybe I don't even sense them, but they're here. But just because I don't see it doesn't mean that it's not real. I mean, if you believe in God, then you have to believe in the concept that there are other things out there. And it does not matter. This is the important thing. It does not matter how you cherish and love and, you know, walk with God. It does not matter whether it's through alien contact or whether it's going to your local church. What's important is the spark of God that lies within each of us and how it is that we transfer that out into the world. I am not perfect. I am not perfect. I don't claim to be. But I really try hard to be a good person, you know, not because I feel I have to, but because I want to. I want to be kind to the people that are around me. I want that. But if people around me are not, I am not a pretty person to be with at the same time, because I stand up for myself. So all love and light and beauty and everything else is great. But if you're getting treated badly, you need to stand up for yourself, because here's what's wrong with the world. We have become complacent. We have become complacent with the people that we have in positions of leadership. And I mean leadership. I'm not talking about government. Leadership.
Right, right.
Our teachers, and, our doctors, our lawyers.
That complacency is seen almost as a vote in support.
Yes.
In political circles, we call it apathy.
Mm-hmm.
People that are apathetic. Oh, they get mad about it. They stomp their feet about it. They complain at the water cooler. They complain at the assembly line or in the workstation. But they don't do anything about it. They're apathetic about it. And that, we know from even ancient Greek writings, is seen as an endorsement of evil.
Yes, absolutely. I remember one particular incident where I was in a grocery lineup, and, you know, I had my little basket. I didn't have the cart. I had a basket. And I put the basket down. It's quite heavy. This was years ago. I put the basket down. I had a purse. And so I kind of tucked the purse, sort of, putting it behind me almost, under my arm. So it stuck out, I don't know, maybe 6 inches from my back. This woman was crowding me to the point where I couldn't even get my groceries out of that basket onto the conveyor belt. And I said, oh, excuse me. And I was very nice, and I politely turned to her, and I smiled, and I said, oh, I'm sorry, excuse me. And she looked at me and gave me a rude look. Then when I turned around, she stepped even closer to me, and she tried to do it again. And she was actually extremely rude, and she started telling me how disgusting I was and how I was rude and so forth and so on. She was just nasty. Now, the thing is, I'm telling this story for a reason, because everyone's going to be like, oh, my gosh. But this is what happens. This was a little old lady who was fully had all of her faculties, 100%. She was wearing her expensive clothing and her big rocks on her hand, and she was thinking that she was so much better than everyone else around her. And for whatever reason, she didn't like me. And I was trying so desperately to just get my basket emptied. That's all I was doing, and I kept smiling at her. And finally just looked at her and said, excuse me. I said, there is absolutely no reason for you to be so rude to me. And she said, oh, I can't believe you're speaking to your elders that way. And I said, respect has nothing to do with age. It has to do with how you respect other people. And I turned back to the cashier, and I was just livid. The point is, I don't really look at who it is that's being rude. I look at the fact that they're being rude and that they're not acting as responsible citizens of this earth. And if we all stand in that lineup and allow that person being absolutely blatantly rude to us, I don't care who it is, then that's, as you said, it's complete apathy. And then the next time that woman ends up in that lineup, she's going to be twice as bad. And then that, you know, it just keeps going and going and going. So,
well, let me ask you a question, because now this apathy has allowed polar forces to come to power, and they have their finger on ominous buttons.
Yes.
Why do you think it's so important for us not to fail at this time? If we failed 3 times before, a couple times on other worlds, and the aliens, blonde aliens, have worked to get us here, and have worked with several peoples to bring keepers of knowledge here so that they can maintain some kind of continuity, some kind of memory thread back to the third world. Why is it so important that we not fail this time?
Well, a little more complex than, oh, my goodness. In an easy answer, I guess what it comes down to is, it's like saying that they've built us from the ground up. They've given us a great deal of time, of nurturing, of, you know, caretaking, looking, watching over us. And if we fail this time, the bodies which we currently live in will be completely, they will be wiped out. And we will be starting over again. So
okay, do you think we're eternal beings and that we're continually growing through multiple mortal experiences?
Well,
this happens to be a very good one.
Yes. You see, this is the way that I see it. I have to even for myself, the knowledge that they gave me, I have to be able to translate it, okay? So here's the way that I'm going to translate it from my perspective. Again, it needs to be from my perspective, because that's all I have. Now, if I believe, which I do, that I am the spark of God, okay, and that I am a spiritual being, and that I live in multi-dimensions, and that after I leave this body that I'm currently in, I will move on to another dimension. What that means is that because I have such a beautiful place to come to, meaning Earth, as the separate entity in which we live here, being able to, again, be the observer, to look at the stars, the moon, the flower petal, the ant. If my body is then, if all of the bodies of human beings are then wiped out, okay, and they start new, then the new structure that they bring forward, it may take a really long time before we get back to the same point that we're at right now, where we are finally becoming the enlightened spiritual beings that we were meant to be all along. We are coming into our own perfection. We are coming into our own beauty that is the spark of God, the soul within each of us. Am I making any sense?
Yeah, exactly.
So it's really important that, at least for some of us, that we understand that we are spiritual beings, that there is more out there than what currently is going on. And again, you don't have to be an ET just to have this. You can be a deeply religious person, and the two of us can sit down and have, you know, we can hold our hands and look into each other's eyes and know that we both understand God. So it's not where you follow outside, it's where you follow inside that's the most important.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to try and come together, and the gatherings that you're talking about is really fascinating, because of course this is one of the primary, quote, job functions that they asked me to, you know, sort of be a participant in, and that was to begin what they call the gatherings. And the gatherings are of people that are like myself, who have the deeply spiritual understanding and knowledge, and that we are to come together in like mind and in physical bodies as well, to come together. And the purpose for this, I believe, is so that it's sort of multi-layered. I mean, first and foremost, it's because if I myself, and again, I talk about myself a lot because it's easier for me to explain to other people some of the concepts that I have. It's not that I think that I have all of the answers, because, again, I don't. But it's my understanding that for myself, if I raise my consciousness, if I raise my understanding, if I raise my spiritual self or my understanding of God, and truly know that, meaning it was not given to me out of a book, that I feel it within myself, feel it with my heart, which is the only place that we can ever truly find anything, is through your heart. Now, if I can do that, then I automatically will be able to affect the people around me, and if I affect the people around me, I raise them up to my level of understanding, knowledge, consciousness, spiritual self. If that starts to happen, it's a ripple effect around the world. So that's what I believe has happened, is that there's been a base group of people, and I'm not one of them. I'm not one of the base people. But these base people who've been struggling for years and years and years, 20, 30 years, to bring forward this type of information, spiritual information, understanding of any type of information that will raise the consciousness of the earth, including technologies like yourself and that sort of thing. If you have all been doing your jobs, which you have, you've touched everyone else around you. I mean, look at how many people's lives you've changed. So the only reason that I can come forward now with this amazingly intricate and detailed story of my life with these tall blonde aliens is because of all of these people that have come before me. So I hold everyone in the highest esteem for that. So when we are doing this with each other, we then affect the entire earth, and by affecting the earth, we also affect the consciousness of these other beings that we're interacting with as well. Because
so this world, this earth, and the beings that are on this earth are entangled with other worlds in this universe, and even other dimensions. So
yes.
Do you think this is the primary reason why the tall blonde aliens have come to Earth physically at this time?
Yes. Yes.
Do you think there are more of them coming soon?
Yes, I do.
Okay, it seems like, at least to me, I'm kind of a casual observer in this, but I'm pretty intense, that we have a chance as a race to make a huge leap forward in evolution. Now, we know the 2012 end times are nearing, so say the ancient civilizations. Have you been shown by the tall blonde aliens how we will survive when these cataclysms arrive?
Yes.
It
will
not
be
pretty.
There, yes. Well, I can share a little bit with you. You know, some of the information that they gave was almost like someone giving me a grade one or two lesson. You know, I mean, compared to what it is that they tried to put into my mind. But they did tell me that, and I mean, I'm looking at the time right now, thinking I'm going to have to really crunch this up a little bit. They did tell me that.
Okay, we have about 10 minutes or so, but go ahead.
Yeah. There is safe lands, what they called safe lands, all over the planet, basically, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And in these safe lands, or safe zones, that they would, if a great cataclysm did take place, that there would be certain people who would, quote, get a message to be in certain areas at certain times. And if and when a cataclysm did take place, that they could, or potentially, you know, not, it's still to be decided as to whether or not they will protect us in these zones or help us. What I do know is that if a great cataclysm does take place, a great big cataclysm, and let's say 2/3 of the Earth's population dies, and then we'll need to be able to take care of ourselves first and foremost. If you happen to be one of the people that is in the safe lands, they may help you to a certain degree. They may even be walking among us to a certain, you know, here and there. And there are other people, quote, if they are pure of heart, that will be taken off the planet to be with them. Now, someone recently asked me what pure of heart actually means. And what I mean by that is, well, not me, but what they mean by that, from my interpretation of what they've told me, is that you would have to have a great deal of inner will and strength in order to be around them for any length of time. Because when you are around them, their spiritual self, all of the knowledge that they have, sort of just moves through you, and you become integrated with it. So if you don't have a really strong, quote, mental mind, you're not going to withstand it. You'll go insane because it's so much information and knowledge. And these particular bodies and brains are not necessarily set up to be able to function on that type of level. So pure of heart doesn't necessarily mean, it means that you've done a great deal of work to understand the different levels of existence, meaning other dimensions and worlds and so forth and other beings that are out there. And if you do, then at least you're in a good starting point. So they will be here to help us potentially. If and when a great cataclysm does take place, that is the only time that they have told me that they would come here en masse and have a great landing. It's the only time. Because they're not meant to come down here and park on our lawns. And, you know,
in the last few minutes, let's talk a little bit more about the safe lands. I know that you visited Four Corners area.
Yeah.
Obviously, I've driven through the area, and I can tell you if 2 billion people showed up, they would die of thirst in about 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
Where might there be other safe lands around the world, away from coastlines or high on mountains or what?
Well, the coastlines, staying away from the coastlines is definitely one of them. I know that with the indigenous peoples all over the earth, they have their creation stories, and they also have their end time stories. And I was not enlightened as to many other areas on the earth. I was primarily focused in on the Four Corners area, and the relationship with the indigenous peoples of this particular area, the Hopi being one of them. And so there are safe lands all over the earth. What I'm hoping is that within the next year or year and a half, that the indigenous people will come forward and tell us where those safe lands are, because it's my understanding from these tall blonde aliens that the indigenous people of the earth that were taken from the third world and brought into the fourth world, that this is one of the tasks that they were given, was to hold all of this great knowledge that was taken from the third world, that they were that they agreed to be participants and helpers in the end times, and one of the things that they needed to do was to remember where the safe lands were going to be and what it is that how all of us were supposed to be prepared and how we were supposed to prepare ourselves for this particular transition. So,
will some of the people on this world be transported off this world by...
Yes.
Okay.
But very few. Very, very few. Very few.
Yes,
yes.
I heard that as well. I heard that
very
as well.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that there are physical craft here on the earth now just waiting?
Absolutely. I have no doubt of that.
I can tell you where they're not. They're not right here in Western Kentucky. But I have a feeling, and maybe you could corroborate this, that you know, our oceans are largely unexplored, and the sea floor seems like a very ignominious place to hide very large things. Do you think maybe that there are lots of craft sitting under the seas all around our planet, just waiting?
Well, I know, I don't have any direct knowledge of that. I have some vague memory that I've never been able to fully grasp onto, but I do have some sort of vague memory of that. What I can tell you is I have a sketch that I did, I think it was in 1989, 1990, and it points to a spot, and it's telling me that that's where they are, and it is in the ocean. Where that spot is, I won't tell you. I won't divulge that.
Yes. Well, we're pretty familiar with downloads here too, and we've talked about them from time to time. But tonight is not my time; it's your time. What is happening now with Miriam? What are you working on now beyond Blue Star?
Well, I have just started, you know, coming out into the public and, you know, fortunate enough to be here talking with you, so bringing a little bit of this information forward. And also, as we speak right now, I'm actually in the Four Corners area, and I've been in the area talking to a number of different people here in Four Corners, and I hope to continue that relationship and to continue to build and forge relationships with other indigenous peoples around the earth. If I have any means to be able to do that, then I will continue to do that. And if I'm meant to continue the work, I know that I'll be provided for, so that's one of the things that I'm doing. And I'm hopeful that they will be able to come forward and move together as being one of the gatherings that will help lead us into a new world, into a peaceful world. And if we can just take baby steps together, then we will come out on the other side a lot better off. One of the things about this prophecy and many other prophecies is that, as I said in the very beginning of the show, if we can digress way back to the very beginning and state that, you know, we are shown things of potential futures. And I pray every day that those things will not happen and that I will be proven completely and utterly wrong. And if that's the case, then we have been given the gift of sight into the future, and we have taken the other path. So if we continue with what we're doing, trying to educate each other and help us along and be teachers to one another in the process, then maybe these things will not happen. And that's one of the other things that these aliens said, is that the transition of this world does not necessarily need to have to be cataclysms. It can be peaceful and beautiful and wonderful, and it's up to us as to what path it is that we're going to follow.
Very good. Very good. That's what everyone needed to hear, that this is not just irrefutable marching on toward Armageddon. We are in control, and we can choose. But it means no apathy. Understand, Earth explorers, You can listen to this program, but then we require you to act on what you hear. So we want you to go to Miriam's website, alienbluestar.com, order that book so that she will have the means to carry on this work. We greatly, greatly appreciate you coming on the program. I do personally. And we'll definitely be in touch.
I thank you so much, and I'm just honored to be here. I truly, truly am. So.
Well, the honor's ours. We definitely need you more than you need us, let me tell you. Internet radio is just now coming of age, and there are thousands of them that hit the airwaves every month and thousands of them that give up each month. We've been here for 3 years, and we're the fastest growing in North America, and it's only because of guests like you. So we appreciate you.
Thank you.
All right. I'll let you get back to your personal life there and enjoy the rest of your time in Four Corners, and we will get back to preparing to meet the real world in the morning. We'll have this show uploaded in a day or so, and we'll send you a link to it. And those of you that are listening as an archive, make sure, sitting there with your PC or your laptop in hand, get that credit card out or hit that PayPal and get to her website and pick up that book. Thank you very much for coming on the program, and we'll talk to you another time.
Good night.
Good night.